ways that it...
Okay, if you would please say my name is and introduce yourself.
My name is Joseph Wheeler, Concord, Massachusetts.
Okay. And we never ask people their ages, but maybe you'd tell us your date of birth so we could put this in some sort of historical perspective.
I was born on Thoreau Farm in Concord in 1926.
The date?
And November 21.
November 21, 1926. Okay. Now, bearing in mind that we want to hear stories about your early life in Concord that gave shape to what you became later, why don't you tell us about your people and where you were raised and how you grew up and how you began to see the world?
Well, my father was a dairy farmer on Virginia Road, and there were five boys in the family. My mother was a person who became very much interested in local history. My eldest brother, who was 8 years older, became a Quaker in college, and he asked if I would be interested in going to a Quaker seminar after my freshman year in high school. I went on a $20 scholarship that he provided. There I got quite interested in world affairs. Of course, we're talking about the period of World War II. And we were all interested in international affairs in those days. Of course, I was interested in solving the problems of the world. And anyway, there I met Harris Wofford, who later became a U.S. senator from Pennsylvania and the college president and did other things in the federal government. But at that time, he was interested in union now with Britain, or federal union, the union of democracies.
Union now?
Union now, it was called. It was a book by Clarence Strite. Well, I came back and formed a Concord chapter of student federalists. We met in a storefront down in the Mill Dam, which was vacant because of the war. To me, looking back, it seems amazing that a kid at that age would have been involved in something like that.
So what age were you and what shape did it all take?
Well, I was between my freshman and sophomore years when this in high school. I went to Concord High School. And I was involved in this kind of activity in college also. I went to Bowdoin College.
Well, tell me more about this initial organization, the storefront. Tell me all about that.
Well, Clarence Strite believed that there should be a union between democracies, and that involved at that time Britain and France and the United States and a few other countries, that this would be a way of dealing with international problems. The international system had broken down, else we wouldn't have had the war, would we? And other people extended that, said this should be on a worldwide basis. This is before we recognized the Soviet Union as an enemy, but rather saw them as an ally against Hitler. And I think all of this became somewhat impractical went on. With the Cold War developing and so forth, but On the other hand, with the United Nations, they get established during this period. And although it was something less than we had been talking about in terms of world federation, it was an improvement on the League of Nations, which had broken down with the failure to stop the Italians from going into Ethiopia back in 1935. So anyway, after college...
I'm interested in more detail on this early organization.
On the early organization.
We'll get to college.
Well,
tell me the
students, students in high schools and then in colleges around the country gathered together to form the talking groups about World Federation. And in the process, we learned what federation is. We were reminded of our own system and what its unique features were. And it was, among other things, it was very educational, I think, for a very young person to be getting into this sort of subject matter earlier than he otherwise would have. So that... The organization developed. It went beyond Clarence Streight and became an organization with chapters at the mostly at the adult level, but also at the student level. And there was formed something called World Student Federalists, and in the course of the following years, student federalists put on seminars at private schools in various parts of the country, and I was involved in organizing some of those. I remember taking a trip out to California. We had one of these at Pomona College, and then after college. We graduated to the world scene, and there was world federalists, a federation of world federalist organizations, headed by a man named Lord Boyd Orr, who had been a head of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations.
Lord Boyd
Orr.
O-R-R.
O-R-R. He was a wonderful man, a Brit, of course, from Scotland, and we had world student federalists, and it happened that after college I had an opportunity to go to Geneva for a year to study at the Graduate Institute of International Studies there, and because I was there. And there wasn't anybody else around. They made me president of this amorphous organization, and so it was a lot of fun for me. It gave me an opportunity to travel more than I would have in Europe, and to meet people that I wouldn't have otherwise met, and I found it a very exciting thing, even though. The Federalists, which continue to this day, have more modest objectives than they did in those days when we were trying to solve all the problems of the world with a very simple solution.
What sorts of solutions? What were the talking points of this movement?
Well, the talking points were that there had to be better ways of solving problems among peoples, and the way to do this would be to emulate the American system, which the people, in effect, chose to delegate authority to at various levels, at the state level and at the federal level. And in the same way, we would look for that to happen at the world level and to try to bring law to bear on individuals rather than attempt to solve problems by bringing force on nations as a whole. And because today we have attempts to do this, as you know, even as we speak, there is a trial going on of the former Liberian leader in The Hague at a world court, and this is one of those incremental processes, beginning the process of applying a law to individuals at the international level.
And you were right at the cutting edge of this.
I was at the cutting edge. It was very exciting. Now, so I went to college. I went to this graduate institute in Geneva, and then I went to the Litauer School, which is now the Kennedy School, for 2 years in Cambridge. And then
what was it called before the Litauer?
The Litauer School of Public Administration.
Named for?
The Harvard Graduate School of Public Administration, as I think it was called.
And who was it named for?
Oh, Mr. Litauer, I suppose, was a major donor to the formation of this school. But it was succeeded by the Kennedy School, now at Harvard. It's training people not only for public service, but also for service for non-governmental organizations. And plays, I think, a very important educational role. But, of course, this similar roles are being played by many other institutions in the country and in the world today. Anyway, that was back in 1950, 51, 52. Then I went to work... I took a civil service exam, and in those days, believe it or not, in the civil service, there were quotas by state. And if you're from Massachusetts, because we had so many educational institutions, it was very hard to get into the civil service, because it was a quota on how many people from Massachusetts could be hired. But the civil service figured out a way around that. They devised an exam and then hired everybody who passed the exam so that they avoided the problem of having to dole the jobs out by state. So anyway, I, as you can see, was interested in international affairs, and at that time Harry Truman had announced the Point 4 program. It was the fourth point in his inaugural address, which was to help people in developing countries. I think that he had a very simple view of life. He said, you know, those good farmers of Missouri and in the United States can teach people how to grow more food, and it'll be a very positive thing. And there was a big emphasis on education and technical training. So I got a job in the Education and Technical Training Unit of the Technical Cooperation Administration of the Department of State. That eventually morphed into what today we know of as the Agency for International Development. Well, of course, in addition to the Point 4 program, we had in those days the Marshall Plan. And I found myself in getting in on the tail end of the Marshall Plan, working on bringing groups over. They call them productivity teams, to, you know, a group of shoemakers or a group of textile workers or what have you, to come to the United States and see how we did it.
This was part of the Marshall Plan?
Yes, it was a small part of the Marshall Plan, because the Marshall Plan was mostly about transfers of money to permit the Europeans to get back on their feet.
So you were coming at the tail end of the Marshall
Plan. Yeah, and because that was a very successful program in which the people, Europe and the United States and associated countries, developed something we call the Organization for European Economic Cooperation. And Averell Harriman, who ran the program from our point of view, said, I want to deal with just one organization. You Europeans can kind of manage the program yourselves. And they developed something akin to, on a European scale, to the International Monetary Fund, and we created the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the IBRD, and we're now called the World Bank. And so it was the beginning of a process. It didn't result in world federation, but it has gone a long way toward the development of multinational institutions in Europe and the European Union. People can now move freely across borders without passports in Europe. So it's a lot of the objectives of the idealists of 1945 have been achieved, at least at that level, and also the development of other international organizations, I think, has been a very positive move. So anyway, then I got involved in the Italy desk, and the Greece desk, and the Turkey desk, and we were keeping track of the balance of payments almost on a daily basis. Of the various countries that we were helping in Europe, because it was very important that we keep those countries from going bankrupt, I am amazed thinking back at what a great success the Marshall Plan was It brought the recovery of Europe, and it also developed, of course, the NATO, the coordinated process, which took care of our defenses during the Cold War.
And how were you keeping track of these various balance sheets? How did that go?
Sounds like a lot. We got reporting from the countries. And the reporting from the countries was vetted in Paris, which was where the OEEC was located. And then we gave our own critical review of these things, and we matched them up with other things that were happening. I remember one time the Greece balance payments improved a great deal because there was a very cloudy summer in France, and the French needed grapes with more sugar to make their wine, and the Greek balance of payments went zooming up, we were following this kind of thing in great detail. It was fun. So I was Greece desk officer and Turkey desk officer, and then along about that time, we had an election in which Jack Kennedy was elected.
Could we get before Kennedy's election?
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about the early 50s and your developments in this. Were you and your associates frustrated with developments in Korea at that time? How did that all play out?
No, that wasn't something I was working on. I, in addition to after Italy and Greece and Turkey, I also worked in the India Technical Assistance Program. And
but here we were sliding into a larger and larger, what, police action, called it then?
Yeah, that was a political military kind of a thing rather than, I mean, it's true that aid got involved in Korea, but I was just never involved in it.
Okay.
I'm going to get to the Peace Corps. Yeah.
Now we're getting to the election of
Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was elected, and one of his things that he supported was the idea of establishing a Peace Corps. And Sergeant Shriver was made head of the Peace Corps. And who did he hire as one of his important staff members but Harris Wofford, the same Harris Wofford that I had met at this Quaker seminar when I was after my freshman year in high school. And Harris wondered if I might be interested in joining the staff of the Peace Corps. And so I did, and I quit aid and went over to the Peace Corps. And I worked on Near East and South Asia. And during that time, there was a need for an acting Peace Corps representative in India for several months. So I went out there, and it was at the time that Ambassador Galbraith was ambassador there. And that meant visiting the first volunteers that had arrived there and developing programs for later groups of volunteers. It was a very exciting time for me. And in the Peace Corps, we were inventing the Peace Corps as we went along. We had all these policy issues that seemed so trivial today. But, you know, is it all right for the men to grow beards? Is it all right for Peace Corps volunteers to marry one another or to marry a person from the country during their term of service? And we had to answer all of it. You know, should a volunteer have a refrigerator or in order to be living at the level of the people that they were working with, should they forego the refrigerator? And there were all kinds of issues about standards of living for the volunteers that we had to deal with. One thing I learned from Sergeant Shriver, of course, he had a special relationship in the government, being the brother-in-law of the president. But I learned that you can do things that I didn't realize you could do. Like, you can fire people. you bring discipline to the process, and you can bring energy and ideas into the process to an extent that I had not realized would be possible. And I felt that this stood me in good stead in my future career. One of the rules of the Peace Corps was you weren't supposed to stay too long. And after 2 years, I was invited back to AID to run the Greece, Turkey, Iran, Cyprus, and Central Treaty Organization office. And so this was a sort of a step up in the hierarchy. And I had all these desk officers working for me. And that was an interesting period in which I was doing some negotiations on the, for example, an important example was a negotiation on the financing of the Kaban Dam, a dam on the Euphrates in Turkey, where we were very anxious that the Europeans make an appropriate contribution, but we had to insist that they provide their assistance on the same concessional basis that we were willing to provide our assistance, so that we'd all be on a level playing field in the competition for contracts. And that was, it, you know, it made me aware of some of the problems you get into in international development.
Such as?
well, the need to have a certain amount of harmonization of the rules of international development among the donor community. Well, after a couple years at that, I was asked to become the mission director in Jordan. Now,
what year are we talking about by this time?
We're talking about 1965, 65 to 67. And Jordan was an interesting country. It back in 10 years earlier, the British decided that they could no longer take the lead in being supportive of Jordan for financial reasons, and they asked the United States to take over that role, and which we did. And that meant that we were making cash payments once a month to support their budget, and we were providing a lot of technical assistance. It happens that in Jordan, for some reason or other, contrary to what we were doing in the rest of the world, we concentrated a great deal on the development of their education system. And we built schools and we trained teachers and we helped them develop textbooks and all of the things that you have to do if you're going to have a good education system. That means that Jordan today is, among Arab countries, is one of the most literate and has provided some of the best workers to the Gulf and so forth. And with the problems in Lebanon, it's also become something of a financial center. Now, Jordan was special because the Palestinians played a very important role, and Jordan at that time administered the West Bank. So my purview included the West Bank, including that part of Jerusalem, which was run by the Jordanians. And our challenge was to consider in this country, which had very few resources other than human resources, to consider things that we could do which would make it possible for them to be a prosperous country. And we came up with tourism as an important element. And this is another exception to policy in Washington. We always look down on Washington and its views. In Washington, they said tourism is bad. That's too trivial. Economic development is production. Well, the thing is that they had very little to produce in Jordan. So we persuaded the powers that be in Washington that it would be all right to bring the National Park Service out to Jordan to develop parks. And, Jordan has some of the great antiquities, Jerash and so forth. And of course, at that time they had the Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, and they had Jerusalem. Much of the old city of Jerusalem. And so we developed this program, and it was going along very nicely. And I recall I had as a claim to fame flying below sea level, because I took Secretary of the Interior Udall, over to Qumran in a helicopter, and of course Qumran is 1,200 feet below sea level. It was sort of an interesting experience. We wondered what would happen to the altimeters in the planes when they get below sea level. But we worked very hard with farmers in the Jordan River Valley, and we also were interested in replicating something which the Israelis had developed on their side of the Dead Sea, which was the potash. The Dead Sea is full of potash, potassium permanganate, and potassium chloride, and that is an important element in fertilizer. So there was a personal coincidence here, because I had a great uncle named Dale who had participated in the 1840s in a expedition of the Navy to study the origins of the River Jordan and the Dead Sea. And they had gone over there and they had taken soundings all over the Dead Sea. And when the feasibility study for the plant for potassium came forward, there was a map that my great uncle had devised as one of the touchstones in the history of the Dead Sea. But anyway,
so what
happened?
Was there any resistance in Jordan to the ideas that higher education?
Oh no, they liked it.
They liked it.
Oh yes.
Who were you working with? I don't mean necessarily names, but what sorts of leadership were you working with in Jordan? Was it a tribal situation?
Jordan had a large minority ran Jordan. These are what we can call the desert Arabs, and the majority being Palestinians at that time. And the Palestinians culturally seemed to have a predilection toward education. And it's very important in their culture. Something like education was an area in the government that the Jordanians were quite happy to have the Palestinians running. So I think they were very anxious to have this program, and because they were anxious to have it, it worked out very well. Now, what happened, of course, is that all of a sudden there was the 1967 war. And I found myself dealing with a couple hundred thousand refugees. Of course, the government of Jordan was primarily dealing with these refugees, but we gathered together all of the... There was a brand that Sears Roebuck had of tents called the Ted Williams tent, and we gathered up all the Ted Williams tents in the United States and had them shipped to Jordan. And I was down in the valley showing the refugees how to put these poles together to put up these very temporary shelters so that they could get out of the sun. That was a very traumatic time. USAID played a bit of a brokering role. All of a sudden, it was important to develop an exchange rate between the shekel and the dinar. There hadn't been a trade between the two countries, and they didn't have an exchange rate. All of a sudden, it was very important to have an exchange rate because the Israelis were occupying the West Bank, and they were continuing to use the dinar over there. So we had to, I found myself passing messages back to Washington to go to the IMF to sort out these issues in a time when direct communications were not normal between those two entities. It was an exciting time. and I think we played a positive role in helping to begin the process of absorbing the refugees from the West Bank.
But you must have been so undone by this war. Here you are, somebody who already for 20 years you've been striving for world government and
right
and federalism and world peace, and now this.
Oh yes, it was a very disappointing.
Talk about a little more about the war and its impact on the policies you were trying to develop.
Well, actually, I think that the government of Jordan, after a period of adjustment, just went on, not having responsibility anymore for the West Bank, but it had the East Bank, the Transjordan part of the country, and they went on, remember, we had the oil crisis, and there was a great demand for Jordanians to help the oil-rich countries to spend their money. And so that there were a lot of workers' remittances coming into Jordan, and they had in the years following the war, there was an internal almost a civil war between the Palestinians and the what I am calling the Desert Arabs, the establishment in Jordan, and that worked itself out. And
what were the issues there?
Well, it was just who was going to run the country, and King Hussein was a moderate who wanted to keep his ties open to the West, and of course eventually he participated in a rapprochement with Israel, and so he was well ahead of where public opinion was among the Palestinians at that time. But I am not an expert in the period following. It is somewhat appalling to think that generations of diplomats have spent their entire diplomatic life dealing with these issues and without having achieved settlement of the basic problems of the region. And so far be it from me to suggest that there are simple solutions. Well, after that, I was invited to come back to Washington to take a job as a deputy assistant administrator for Near East and South Asia. And that would have been 1967, late 67. And then I did that for a couple of years. And then I was invited to become the mission director to Pakistan, 1969, and I had a very long tenure there of 8 years, which I think in terms of single management of mission is maybe the record in the service. And I met my wife in Pakistan, and we married. We were putting two families together, and we had been going on happily ever after. And it was terrific having her there, because she had been living in Pakistan a couple of decades before and knew Pakistan in a way that very few people did. So I was very pleased to get her advice on many subjects. Whether I asked for it or not, she gave it to me. And, well, Pakistan is a very interesting country. It's much more important than I think that most Americans have realized. Today it has about 175 million people, which is more than half the population of the United States. It's, sixth largest country in the world in population or something like that. When I left, it only had 75 million people. But that was, when I left it, I left half a country because in 1970 there was the events of 1970 which led to the independence of Bangladesh, and which at that time represented 53% of the total population of Pakistan.
Can you give us sort of the highlights of that?
Well, East Pakistan and Bangladesh is somewhat different culturally. They share Muslim religion, but I think that they had different language. The Bangladeshis tend to be very articulate, very thoughtful. Some people would say maybe a little less practical. of course, they're shaped by their geography. I mean, they are a delta. And in the middle of the country, Dhaka is only 16 feet above sea level. So every year there is a huge flood in the spring, which inundates much of the country. It also provides nutrients to the rice crop, but it's a country which is always on the edge of a disaster. So when I went to Pakistan in 1969, I figured out that I should be giving priority to two things, really. One, population as an issue, and secondly, growing rice in East Pakistan. And I think the joke is that after 8 years, I was much more successful in population in East Pakistan than in West. Or I should say, they were much more successful, since most of the activity is theirs rather than ours. But we were very successful in growing more wheat in West Pakistan.
Now, how do you explain those differences in population, for example?
Well, on the population issue, this has to do with family planning, and I think that it has. An easier relationship in East Pakistan, in Bangladesh, among people, probably less hierarchical, less feudal. I think also that East Pakistan is a country about the size of Wisconsin, but today it has 150 million people in it. So that they recognize the issue more readily than they do in Pakistan, which today's Pakistan, which is much larger and seems to be much larger because of the mountains and the desert, which occupy a very large portion of the country. They give a sense of room. And so the government took the issue of family planning very seriously over there. And so that it's a bit of a miracle, but this is since I left the program. But they've brought their fertility rate, the number of children per family, down from close to 7 to about 3.3 over the last 25 years or so. And that's almost a miracle, because we talk about family planning. The solution is girls' education. But of course, people, the girls in Bangladesh are not very well educated, and yet they've been very successful in this program. And it has to do with the development of a program which reached the smallest village, the groups of houses that would exist on somewhat higher levels of land, surrounded by ponds and rivers. It's only when development reaches the people in a real sense that you can say you've been successful. A lot of other things have happened in Bangladesh. This is where the idea of very small levels of loans, mini loans, was developed, and a Nobel Prize was given to Abbas or something, that Yunus,
yeah.
who has got a system going where a woman can get the money to buy a sewing machine, and all of a sudden she has a little income, or to buy some chickens, or to buy a cow, or, you know. And they've done the same thing with in education. They've hired girls with just a few years of education as teachers, teaching in a house in a village. And that's the beginning of the universal educational system. You know, from there, you get a more educated teacher and you get a more sophisticated school. But you begin by giving universality to the practice of education. And so they've done a number of things that are right over there, which I think is very important.
But that's
Bangladesh.
The population issue was one, though, that your mission really really locked on to.
Yeah, we provide a very generous aid in this field. And we experimented on a large scale and learned lessons in our failures. There was a theory that if you made condoms available universally, you know, in all the tea shops of the country, that they would get used. And I think it turned out that, you know, all the statistics said we were being very successful as we were filling up the pipeline. Then we discovered that they weren't getting used at the end of the pipeline at the retail level, because there was no one really, no person of the village talking to other people in the village about the family planning. It was too concentrated at central and bureaucratic levels above the village, and so that
without that local connection, then it would be too much of an abstraction for people.
Yes, and Pakistan's fertility rate is over 5 today. So Pakistan is growing in numbers as fast as the United States in numbers, even though we're growing at a very slow rate. I mean, we're at sort of a little over 2-child family level, whereas they're 5-child family level. But in an area that was of great interest to them, we had an enormous success in our wheat program. This is the Green Revolution, and the Green Revolution involves a number of things. It did involve the magic of the new seeds. These are seeds which the plants would, if they were fertilized, would not grow taller and taller, but rather would put up more shoots, and thus grow, and thus have more grain per acre, much more grain per acre. If in the old varieties of wheat, fertilizer would cause the wheat to grow higher and higher, and then in a windstorm or rainstorm, it would lodge and rot, and you wouldn't get the production. Well, all right, so you have to have the magic of the seed, and you have to have fertilizer, and you have to have water. So we developed a fertilizer strategy. This had to do with, you know, major policy issues. The price that the government would pay farmers for a unit of wheat, and the price that would be the fertilizer would be available at. At that time, this was the period that Prime Minister Bhutto was in charge, and he had a socialist attitude toward things, and I think even well-meaning, his idea was that in the remotest part of the country, you should pay the same for fertilizer as you do near the fertilizer plant. And from an idealistic point of view, that sounds right, doesn't it? But from a marketing point of view, it doesn't take into account the cost of marketing in the remote areas. And the result was that with a general shortage of fertilizer, the fertilizer was being monopolized by farmers near the fertilizer plant, and there just wasn't any available for the people that they meant to serve. So we wanted to get these to free up the from socialist control, so to speak, from government control, the distribution of the fertilizer, to get fully adequate supplies of fertilizer in the country, including the increase in production of fertilizer in Pakistan, and so we had a whole strategy. The government of Pakistan bought into it. There was a the government of Pakistan. There was a dramatic moment when the Prime Minister signed off. It happened that I was out of town that day, but my wife sat next to the Prime Minister, and he said to her,
"Sorry?"
He said to her, "Well, your husband will be happy with me today. I signed off on the fertilizer policy change."
And this came after a long period of working with him on this?
Well, we worked with the government. We didn't work directly with him. He worked with his advisors. But it was economic diplomacy at its best, I would say. I was very pleased. And we had worked very hard on it. And we'd done lots of papers and analyses and so forth. And the Pakistanis are a very able group of people, the people running planning commission and aid programs and so forth were very well educated and understood these issues. And so they were able to take the analysis up the political ladder to the Prime Minister and get his assent. But it was of such political importance that it had to be signed off on at the top. Now the other...
Did the mission have a philosophic problem with socialism in addition to the fact that it wasn't working in this particular case? I mean, was there this feeling that we have to...
Well, I think that people who are skeptical about socialism tend not to be so philosophical about it as pragmatic. That the thing is that it's that the profit motive is a great engine, in the economic process, and whereas we very much wanted to help the total population to achieve a better life, we had a different approach to how that better life might be achieved. I don't think I should need to go into the argument, but you can see that that there was a real problem, the way the government was running the fertilizer industry at the time. Now, one of the things we thought was that the production of fertilizer should be in the private sector, and we financed a fertilizer plant during that period, which was almost in the private sector. It was run by the retired officers of the Army, but which was a sort of a separate authority, decision-making separate from the government. And so that it was a strategy that in the long run has worked very well.
To provide a model, an alternative model?
Yes, but it's not just a model. We were producing wheat for the whole country. I mean, our goal was to double the wheat production in a matter of 5 years. And we saw it happen. And since I left Pakistan, I mean, at the beginning of this process, it was between a 4 and 5 million ton crop. And then it went up to 9 to 10 million tons. And now it's over 20 million tons. So it, one feels that a process got going that has been successful ever since. Now, I've left out of this equation the need for water. And water is everything. You know, Pakistan basically is a desert with rivers flowing through it. Maybe it's a little bit like California. I don't know. But the Punjab, which is the big province, Punjab means five rivers. And at the time of partition between India and Pakistan, the headwaters of two of those rivers were in India. And the Indians decided that they would like to use the water in those rivers for themselves. Now, this may be under international law, there is something called riparian rights. And you're not supposed to take water away from the lower riparians. And there was a big Indus Basin dispute. This is before my time in Pakistan. And there was a negotiation that took place with the World Bank to taking the lead in the negotiation, in which India was able to keep the water from its rivers, but Pakistan got it replaced by the building of major dams, which would make more efficient use of the Indus River and two other rivers that are part of that Punjab. and then they had canals that would take whole rivers of water from one river to the next, replacing the water that is now flowing, not flowing into Pakistan, but being used in India. And it was, but then we discovered that there is a sort of a process that goes on. Too much irrigation raises the water table. And when the water table breaks surface, you get an evaporation and a salt residue. And millions of acres of water were being lost, of land were being lost to agriculture. And they brought in one of our Renaissance men, Roger Revelle, who had a team that would come up with a scheme for dealing with this. And the scheme that was developed was to put in major tube wells. So you had electricity going to tube wells, bringing the water up out of the ground, lowering the water table, flushing the salts back down into the subsoil or off into the drainage system. And so this was known as the Salinity Control and Reclamation Program, or SCARP. Well, this was still going on in my day, and I was very anxious to take that program further steps, and we developed what was known as on-farm water management. We discovered that most of the water that arrived at the farmer's field was wasted. It was wasted because the field was not as flat as this table. And therefore, in order to get water to a higher part of the field, you put too much water on another part. And so it needed to be flattened out, the movement of soil. And then there was a need for developing, because there was a certain flow from the clay water channels into the field, there was erosion, and there's a need to have something that was what we called a pakanaka, an improved way of getting the water from the water channel to the field. And we worked on this with local artisans and developed a local industry building these inexpensive land levelers that could be pulled with an ordinary tractor and get rid of the bulldozers. And so this was a very important development during my 8 years in Pakistan.
You know, one thing we didn't touch on earlier was your relationship to farming as a child.
Yes.
Could you reflect on that for just a little bit here and how that experience shaped your...
Well, the dairy farm in Concord was... We did not have the best land in Concord down on Virginia Road, but we had some land which was pretty good. And so we had some for swamp land where we grew trees, a woodshed, and we had some sandy land that we used for asparagus, and we had some very heavy loamy land that could be cultivated with some difficulty, and we had some pretty good fields. And in the course of my time, we converted from horse-driven equipment to machine-driven equipment, and so I saw we weren't pioneers in this area, but I saw that it happening on our farm, and I saw the experiments that the Soil Conservation Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture had persuaded my father to try on with fertilizer plots, and the remarkable increase in the amount of hay that he was able to get as a result of this, and the various work that he did in conservation and putting in water retarding systems to retard the flow of water so that it would go into the groundwater. And it was having that immediate experience, I suppose, made me especially interested in the whole problem of how you grow wheat. I think the Green Revolution is a phenomenon hasn't been written enough about.
In Pakistan or
China? Well, no, in the world. When I was office director for the countries, including Turkey, we had a mission director in Turkey who wanted to increase the wheat production in Turkey. So he got all the experts together, and Turkish on the Turkish side and the American side, and they studied and they worked and they figured out what would be needed, and there were maybe 25 interventions that would be needed, some at the policy level and some in terms of equipment and supplies. And they took this to the Prime Minister of Turkey and said, you know, this is something we'd like to make a major effort on, but we'll only make it if you will appoint one person reporting to you weekly on the progress being made on the program, and who will sort of bring together the, coordinate this disparate effort, complicated effort. Well, the person that they selected was an engineer who later was Turgut Özal, who became Prime Minister of Turkey. And so it's sort of an example of how you have to work both at the political level and throughout the hierarchy and at the farmer level in order to achieve what needs to be achieved. Well, Jim Grant, the mission director, who later became head of UNICEF. Before that, he ran our aid program in Vietnam. Of course, Vietnam is a very controversial subject, but one of the things that we did in Vietnam during the heyday of development there was to work on their rice crop. I don't remember the years, to tell the truth, but I guess it would have been
early 60s?
Late 60s. That was a great success, and we actually got a tremendous increase in the rice crop.
How'd you do that?
Well, with the improved varieties, which were developed to some extent at international research centers. In the case of rice, it was in the Philippines. In the case of wheat, it was in Mexico. And in the case of maize or corn, it was also in Mexico. And these international research institutions contributed the seed varieties. There's a lot of experimentation, of course, and adaptation and gradual changes and improvements. And it's easy to oversimplify these things, but you need to in order to communicate about them, I guess. But anyway, so that the Turkey experience led to that Vietnam experience, and then we get into the India experience and the Pakistan experience. And India has had a great success in improving its grain production, and well, it really needed to, because their population's gone up fourfold in this 50-year period. So they would be in bad shape if they hadn't succeeded in increasing their wheat crop and their rice crop.
A fourfold as well, or more?
Yeah, well, I think that, I guess, for the country as a whole, I think it's perhaps fourfold. I haven't looked at the statistics lately. India. But Pakistan has the largest integrated irrigation system in the world. And so it's particularly well-suited for a green revolution kind of an operation. And so it was, I think one of the things that these days as we talk, Pakistan is in a time of troubles. And we're very concerned about how things are going to turn out politically. But it's very important, I think, to realize that this is not a stagnant situation, that this is a country which has grown enormously from a point of view of agriculture production, from point of view of manufacturing, and from the point of view of the education of its elite. Whereas I have complaints about policy in Pakistan. It's not giving enough attention to education at the primary school level, to health systems, and so forth. There's no question about what they have an enormous capacity and have made great strides. And so we shouldn't underestimate the importance of the country or the importance of the gains that it's made.
You had early, fairly early cooperation from Bhutto, but you had other connections with the family too, did you, or, over the years?
Well, Bhutto had a family. And his eldest was Benazir Bhutto, who was recently assassinated. And she went to school with two of our daughters at Radcliffe. And so she was in the house a couple of times in Islamabad, and my kids visited her in Karachi at her home there. So yes, we had that relationship. Mrs. Bhutto was, I think, a very positive force. She was head of the Red Cross.
She was a very fine person.
Yeah.
Really cared about her family.
Yeah. And Verona got to know her a little bit. Generally, aid directors didn't deal at the prime ministerial level. I would accompany the aid administrator to meetings in Mr. Bhutto's office from time to time, training up my administrator to say the right things in support of our program.
literally putting words in their mouth.
In his mouth, yeah, right. And I saw him. I remember one particular lunch we had in Balochistan when my boss from Washington, Maury Williams, was President Nixon's disaster relief coordinator. Now, after independence, after Bangladesh and Pakistan broke up, there was a new disaster, which was a terrible flood that covered a couple million acres, and we wanted to be helpful on that. And so Maury Williams came out, and he had this message from the president to deliver, and so we arranged to have lunch with him in Balochistan. And so I had my interesting contacts in that sense, but in general, we worked with the high levels, but not the highest levels of bureaucracy.
So that the events in Pakistan of the past month must have been particularly excruciating for you to see her come back, to see this wave of popular excitement.
Yes, I think that we find Pakistan a very complex place. I mean, you have so many different cultures, so many different languages, points of view represented, and it's really hard to, for the outsider, even for the insider, to fully understand how things work in Pakistan. But we have a special interest right now because Rona's elder daughter is working with the aid mission on earthquake relief, and she's an Urdu speaker, and is, you know, there was the earthquake 2 years ago that killed, I think, 75,000 people, and it eliminated many villages and left others in pretty much of a rubble. And so that there's been an effort to rebuild facilities and to provide health and education and transportation and job opportunities for people, housing potential. So she's been working on that program with USAID in the embassy. So we keep in very close touch with Pakistan.
What is her name?
Merrily Kane.
Merrily Kane.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is just fascinating.
Yeah. So that, yes, that our lives keep crossing. We went out to visit Merrily in February, and we had an opportunity to meet with some of our old friends, who were 30 years older than when we left Pakistan in 1977, and to have conversations with them and sort of catch up with things. Now, that was really just before the current problems emerged in a serious way.
Before Musharraf took power?
Yeah, well, you know, he had taken power some years ago, 8 years ago, but before he declared martial law, or the equivalent of martial law. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I finished up in Pakistan in 1977, came back to Washington, and became assistant administrator of aid for Near East. And the exciting thing there was, of course, twofold, I think. One is supporting our budget before those committees of Congress. And I remember the terrific time I had testifying before Congressman Hamilton's committee, and the difficult times I had before Congressman Long's Appropriation Committee.
Give us some of the highlights of that that were so memorable for you.
Well, I think on the Hamilton Committee, these are people who know a lot about the area that I was dealing with. And so they were interested in going into more substance on programs that might otherwise have been the case. And at one point, my staff and their staff got together and decided that we would do a hearing in which we would discuss only the future, only emerging trends. And it was an interesting exercise, I found, because what we discovered was that we hadn't been paying as much attention as we should have been paying to the phenomenon of urbanization, to the haven't been treating as important as it was the phenomenon of workers' remittances. Yeah, this is where Egyptians are working in another country and sending money home. And, you know, that becomes a very important engine of development. And it goes to family members. So it means that you're building houses and you're giving education opportunities and lots of things. It's an engine of growth. And there are issues of that sort that we were able to talk about. And I appreciated Congressman Hamilton being receptive to the idea of looking at these new ideas, the ideas that were new to both him and us. And then I think that one thing we're very critical, we Americans, of the political problems that occur in countries where they simply are unable to adopt the policies we think they ought to adopt. Today, we're talking about it in terms of Iraq, but of course, for me, it was in Pakistan or in Egypt and so forth. And the The trouble is that we have the same problem in our own political system. I mean, we've wasted enormous amounts of money because we've insisted that grain that we supply has to go on American bottoms, ships, and that this is becomes a subsidy to the American shipping industry. And it costs maybe twice as much to send something to